From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. Sponsored by Exicon, enabling your groundbreaking microRNA discovery. This week on the GenCast Network. Dr. George Kalin from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center is interviewed by Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling on microRNAs and cancer.
Dr. George Kalin is an associate professor in the Department of Experimental Therapeutics at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. Previously, Dr. Kalin was an assistant professor at Ohio State University. His areas of interest include cancer, gene expression, and non-coding RNAs. Dr. Kalin, why has work on microRNAs become such a hotbed of research activity in the life sciences?
You know, I think the answer is very simple. Everything what is new, exciting, and unexpected is very interesting for the scientists. You know, nobody was thinking that in the human genome, still something important should be discovered after the genome was sequenced. You know, in 2001, the people were thinking genomics is a dead science. You know, everything was sequenced by two different groups. The sequences come nice along. In 2003, all the people were quite sure to tell that 99% of the genome is nice. You can read it. And unexpectedly, you know, 100,000, tens of thousands of non-coding RNAs could not be translated in proteins, you know, and from here start everything. And I think also, you know, it's also something, a second reason. Everybody who start working with microRNAs, quite instantly, you know, overnight, start having answers to questions unanswered for years, you know. So basically there are two reasons, something unexpected and something very useful for all type of scientists, biologists, physicians, and so on. For example, I'm a gastroenterologist training emergency medicine and so on. I was working with Carlo Croce in that period in 2000, cloning of genes on chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And, you know, overnight, we found miR-15/16 is the most deleted region in CLL, and from this, we start having paper after paper, tens of papers on microRNAs involved in cancer. No? So this is, I think, the answer.
That leads to my next question. What's the evidence for a significant role for microRNAs in cancer?
I think the question should be, what aren't the significant, because now there are so many. There are more than 500 or 600 papers published from our initial paper in 2002 till now, so in 5 years. On microRNAs and cancer. And I think there are three big evidences. First, microRNAs are involved in initiation of cancer, so in the earliest stage. Why? Because we found, and all the people found, not only one group, there are hundreds of groups who move in the same direction. We found differences in expression from the earliest stages of tumorigenesis, from adenoma stage, for example, in colorectal cancer tumorigenesis. And the second, we found, very important, and I will come back during other questions, we found the germline mutation in microRNAs involved in familial cancers and involved in mouse models of cancers. The second, it's microRNAs are involved in progression of tumors, which is very important. A tumor has to be established. And then the cells divide in a very strange way. MicroRNAs are involved also in progression. And third, very important, these are publications in the last 5 months, MicroRNAs are involved in metastasis. So basically in all the steps of tumorigenesis, you find abnormalities of MicroRNAs, expression or sequence or differential transcription or alteration in processing. So these are, I think, the most important evidence.
In an article you co-authored in the March 1st issue of the International Journal of Cancer, you and your colleagues made reference to the main paradigms for miRNA involvement in human cancers. What were these paradigms?
They are very simple. First, differences in expression can be found in any type of cancer. So it doesn't matter with what type of cancer you are working, microRNAs should be differentially expressed and should be altered also in other ways, methylation, sequence variation, differential processing, and so on. The second, microRNAs are tumor suppressors and oncogenes. And we have examples. It's Frank Schlack seminal paper on LET7 and RAS, LET7 tumor suppressor. microRNA 1516 tumor suppressor. It's Joshua Mandel paper with 1792 and Scott Hammond paper on 1792, the first oncogene in microRNAs. There are groups and groups, including Carlo Croce, 155 oncogene in cancer. 1792 is an oncogene. If I told tumor suppressor, it was a mistake. So we start having a lot of evidence that microRNAs are working in the way in which protein-coding genes are working in cancers, tumor suppressors and oncogenes. Now, these two are very nice things, but for scientists. The issue is the patients are dying by cancer. No? So the third paradigm is, in my opinion, very important. microRNAs are diagnostic and prognostic markers. And this is really important because this can be translated in something useful and very efficient for patients. The fourth one, again important in my opinion, microRNAs and non-coding RNAs could be the missed link in cancer predisposition. For at least 30 years, the people were looking for the causes of familial cancers, and very few genes, protein-coding genes, light up as important players. APC, BRCA1, BRCA2, and, you know, you never can pass more than 10, 20 real big examples. I think microRNAs can be postulated as putative players in cancer predisposition, and we published a paper, it's another paper by Ravecchia in Blood last year, and this year we'll light up a lot of papers showing mutations in microRNAs linked to cancer predisposition, cancer risk, and so on. And then the last one, very important, you know, everybody knows, but nobody is talking too loud, the fact that doesn't matter NIH spent $1 trillion or more dollars in cancer-related grants, the mortality by cancer did not decrease significantly, including the United States, the richest country in the world, in the last 20, 30 years. And I don't know if you know a very scary figure, one American died by cancer per minute in 2007. So basically everybody understand, but did not stress too loud, that cancer therapy apparently did not have a significant improvement in the survival. So every new discovery should bring a new hope that maybe these type of genes are important. And, you know, ribozymes were used for therapeutics, small interfering. Now it's a time of microRNAs. So microRNAs as possible gene therapeutic agents. You know, and this is a very good idea because in respect with all other type of agents, you know, oligo antisense, ribozymes, small interfering, microRNAs have two advantages. First, are produced normally inside the human cells. So certainly, each cell should have a specific proteic machinery to regulate and to take care of the function of specific microRNAs. So if a microRNA is overexpressed, you can turn it down in that cell, and the proteins involved in the regulation of expression are present naturally in the cell. If a microRNA is downregulated, you put it in an exogenous way, and still the protein machinery involved in the regulation of this microRNA is present. You know? And the second advantage, very important, is the fact that the microRNAs did not act only on one target. The microRNAs act on multiple targets. You know? They are negative regulators of protein expression also. There are a few papers who who challenge this dogma, and I think this is also the right way. microRNAs could act also in other ways. But say, the majority of papers tell that microRNAs are negative regulators of protein expression. So if one microRNA is regulating, say, 3-4 proteins involved in an apoptotic pathway, for example, MIR-1516, are targeting BCL2, and we have now a paper in PNAS showing that it's targeting also MCL1, another big player in apoptosis, then delivering this microRNA, 1516, in specific patients with CLL, will have a big effect by targeting both BCL2 and MCL1. So basically, I think the people who have big hopes in this last paradigm of microRNAs as a new cancer gene therapy, they are right. And this is why, for example, I moved from Ohio State to MD Anderson, because in this place, it's a huge amount of patient and support in order to translate this discovery on microRNAs in diagnostic and therapeutics.
Let's go back to your journal paper. Your journal paper, which was titled MicroRNAs in Cancer, Profile, 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 noted that microRNA profiling represents both a diagnostic and prognostic tool for cancer patients. And you touched on that a few minutes ago. Can you explain a little more about the diagnostic and prognostic capabilities?
Yeah, for example, you know, it is basically what the people were doing. They were producing different tools in order to find, to assess the expression. Microarrays, quantitative PCR, flow cytometric-based technologies, serial analysis of gene expression, and so on and so on and so on. What were the results were very interesting. For example, it's a paper by a group at MIT, by Liu et al., from Todd Golub's group, who found that profiling microRNAs in cancers without known primary, so in metastatic cancers, in which the clinician could not find the initial starting point, microRNAs profiling can differentiate this type of cancers from the other cancers much better as profiling EST genes, protein coding genes, which is very important because by using 3, 4, 500 microRNAs, you have better results as using 10, 20, or 30,000 protein coding genes. You know? Second, we were able to find, for example, specific profiles in lung and colon cancers. This is with Curtis Harris from NIH. We were able to find in CLL different profiling for microRNAs who differentiate good from bad prognosis. This is with the people from CLL Consortium in San Diego. The director is Tom Kipps. So, and other were finding in hepatocellular carcinoma, in pancreatic cancers. It's a paper in JAMA by Blumstein from OSU. So, in all type of cancer, the people were able to find that the profiling can differentiate patients with good prognosis from patients with bad prognosis, patients with different clinical characteristics from patients with other clinical characteristics, you know? So, and I think this is extremely exciting because you never know how important could be a new diagnostic and prognostic marker. For example, I give every time this example of a prostate-specific antigen. Nobody knows exactly what is the role, but still saves the lives of millions and millions of men early diagnosed with prostate cancer. So if we found a few microRNAs who are very important in telling what lung patients should got a specific type of therapy, it's very important. For example, again, Curtis Harris and with Carlo Croce, they have a paper in JAMA published a few weeks ago in which they found that the level of expression of miR-21 is very important in predicting the patients who will respond or who will not respond adjuvant chemotherapy in colorectal cancer. Adjuvant chemotherapy, it's one of the main way to treat patients with certain patients with colorectal cancer. So we were able to find the microRNA who can predict the way in which these patients respond to therapy, which is something very important, you know.
Now, my final question here, you're talking about genome-wide profiling to find these diagnostic and prognostic aspects of microRNAs. How are microRNA microarrays and quantitative RT-PCR technologies used in genome-wide profiling? In other words, what's the importance of these technologies in helping you to do these genome-wide studies?
I think there are the main technologies that can be used because microarray also has a lot of problems. You know, you can the specificity for different microRNAs is not 100% and so on and so on. It's still the cheapest way to profile thousands of non-coding RNAs in hundreds of samples in really few days, if not few weeks, you know. You can profile, if you have a very good microarray facility, up to 50, 100 samples a day, so here is not a problem. And also the softwares to analyze this huge amount of data are quite standardized, and you know, the people know how to work. So microarray, it's at this point, if you test the literature, the majority of patients were profiling were profiled by microarray. The quantitative RT-PCR has other advantages. It's extremely precise. It's the gold standard for quantification. And now a lot of companies are providing kits on which you can profile more than few patients a day, because the problem with quantized PCR was the low throughput. So I think the combination between microarray, an initial screening with microarrays, on microarrays and other non-coding RNA. For example, we have a paper in Cancer Cell in September proving that ultra-conserved regions are transcribed as ultra-conserved genes, and a good part of this one are non-coding. So you can put on the array what probes you want to analyze up to tens of thousands of possible non-coding RNAs. You know? So a first screening with a microarray on hundreds of samples, and then you are confirming and making a much better refinement and definition of your results with quantitative PCR. This combination, I think, it's the best tool. And to give you only one example, we have with Massimo Negrini and a paper in cancer research in 2005 with breast cancer profiling of microarrays. And now Rob Weinberg from MIT published a seminal paper a few months ago finding the first microRNA, STEMB, who is involved in breast cancer metastasis. And they start from that initial report of profiling. And in fact, they found that one of the microRNAs that we found differentially expressed, STEMB, is this big player in cancer metastasis. So basically, array plus quantitative PCR is the first step in understanding the functions of microRNAs in human cancers.
So now, if I was a young researcher about to go into life science research and I was looking at microRNAs, you'd tell me as a young researcher this would be a good idea? Why?
I tell you, you know, you have to think that I start in a communist country where genetics was forbidden. So, and I'm a gastroenterologist. So if I, as a guy who come from a country where I learn by myself, and I'm a gastroenterologist and I'm doing science, I was succeeding in microRNAs, everybody can succeed from this country. This is the rule. And not only being a young scientist and coming in a young field in which you have no rules, your imagination and creativity can be exploited 100%, I think the people have to jump without any problems. And really, in all my talks, I'm inviting all the people to come inside this field, because really it's very exciting and very pleasant when really you are working hard, but also you have good and new results. And much more, you have to keep in mind that doesn't matter. Last year, 3 papers per day were published on microRNAs, about 1,200 papers or more, 3 papers and a half, 4 papers a day. There are tens of thousands of non-coding RNAs, if not hundreds of thousands of non-coding RNAs. So it's enough place for all young scientists to work not with one gene, but with 10 genes for 10 years, and still it's place for more other people. So keep in mind this one and write this one, it's very important. Here it's a field in which creativity and imagination it's extremely welcome, because we have no rules to study and what to understand. Everything is new. For example, come out a paper in Science a few months ago showing that microRNAs are positive regulators of protein expression. It's a paper published by a group from Yale, Steitz. And also a second paper came, I think, a couple of months ago in PNS. I don't remember the name of the authors. I'm sorry of this. They show that microRNAs are targeting the promoters of protein-coding genes. So here the imagination and the mix between good timing and the good model are very welcome. So everybody it's invited here. And if I can help, it's my pleasure to help.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.